From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest is Lawrence Maslin. He's the author of Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture, and he is also the author, along with his partner, Michael Cantor, of a new PBS documentary called Superheroes, The Neverending Battle. He is also the writer of other PBS favorites, including Make 'em Laugh, The Funny Business of America, and Broadway, the American Musical. Lawrence Maslin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be there. I have to give a quick shout-out to my partner in crime-fighting, Michael Cantor, who is the co-writer of the documentary as well.
And you only make documentaries about things that I'm interested in.
Good.
I like that.
Good.
And I'm a big fan of comic books, and this is a beautiful book. And I was lucky enough to also see the three-hour documentary that has a different title. The documentary is called Superheroes, Neverending Battle,
mm-hmm.
and the book is called Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture.
Exactly. Brilliantly done.
Thank you. I got that from reading comic books.
Yeah, there you go. Everything I learned, right?
I started reading comic books in 1966. My first comic on the stands was Superboy, number 123.
Wow.
I still have all my comics.
Your mother didn't throw them out?
No, I wouldn't let her, because I didn't ever leave them alone. I just kept them with me, and I still read them all the time. What about you? Were you a comic book fan?
Yeah, you know, people have asked me, obviously, in the last couple weeks what my first comic book is, and I honestly don't remember. What I do remember, like it was yesterday, was the TV Guide in January of 1966, where they announced Batman would be on TV on Wednesday night.
And you pointed out in the show that was created by Lichtenstein. He created the.
Yeah, I don't know if it was that particular TV Guide. I remember the picture inside. They used to do a little sort of TV spotlight, and there was a photograph of a guy who looked like, you know, the same guy that my friend had the comic book of. So I was totally hooked. I had to check that out, and I was sold from that moment on and became a big comic book collector in the mid-60s through the mid-70s, and then went to college and sort of forgot about it all for a decade or two.
So you haven't continued reading comic books?
Well, I've gone backwards. I mean, once we decided, I mean, I've always sort of kept an oar in. A couple of my friends were collectors and certainly went to see the movies and certainly was interested in, someone would say, oh, there is this thing out called you know, Amalgam Comics, if anybody remembers that.
Right. Uh-huh.
Where DC and Marvel teamed up. So I would check those things out periodically. But working on the series for the last 5 years, I've sort of gone backwards and read everything of significance since I stopped reading comics in the late 70s.
And now, do you think you'll continue reading comics? Or
I think I'll continue being selective about what I read,
well,
for sure.
You know, that's one of the, you know, and I want to point out that the book and the special are not a history of comic books so much as a history of the superhero.
No, hence the first word in each, right?
Right, so. Right. Although, you know, superheroes began in the comic books, especially now, the comic books is like a peripheral part of what they do.
Right.
And in the special and in the book, you talk about how comic books, and I guess it would be true of other forms of popular culture as well, but comic books reflect what's going on in society throughout the periods of time that you divide into the 3 hours of your special.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, the industry, the comic book industry, essentially began in the mid-30s. It didn't really begin in earnest with superheroes until the spring of 1938 when Superman debuted in Action Comics. And it's a very interesting industry. I mean, the subtitle of our documentary is called A Never-Ending Battle, and it's not just Superman versus Lex Luthor. It's the battle of this business to gain respect, to gain readers, to deal with different assaults from politicians, from the media. And sometimes the comic book industry has been ahead of the curve, as in the days leading up to World War II, and sometimes it's been behind the curve, I think, in terms of its dealing, say, with women and women superheroines or superheroes in various periods in its history.
I guess one of the controversies of the comic books is who created what.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get into that?
A little bit. I think some of it's pretty darn clear. I think it's clearer than you'd think. in the sense we know Siegel and Shuster created Superman. A fellow named Bob Kane took a lot of credit for creating Batman when he actually worked with a guy named Bill Finger, and later with another fellow who we interviewed, we were able to interview, named Jerry Robinson. And I suppose those people who are listening who are fans of the Marvel heroes in the 60s, you know, Stan Lee, who wrote every single Marvel comic for at least 3 years in the early 60s, there's been a sort of bit of a blowback saying, oh, he didn't really, Jack Kirby did it or Steve Ditko did it. But I think in our estimation, Stan Lee deserves a lot of credit for what he came up with and what he sustained with Marvel Comics.
Well, I guess one of the interesting questions about the Kirby-Lee collaboration, and I guess in some ways it's kind of like Lennon and McCartney, you know, who did what, because neither of them created anything as lasting as they had created together.
Well, except Stan Lee sure created Spider-Man without Jack Kirby.
Well, that's true, but I mean in that same period of time.
Spider-Man was the third or Spider-Man was, well, I'm trying to think, the third creation within 14 months.
Although Kirby claims to have had a big hand in the creation.
Yeah, I'm not a comic book archaeologist, but I've never, you know, I give Jack Kirby and those guys all the credit in the world, but I also, maybe because I'm a writer, you know, Stan Lee was the one who came up with those soap operas in Spider-Man. I mean, one of the great writers of the 70s, we quote, says the great creation was not Spider-Man, it was Peter Parker. And I'm sure a lot of readers identified with Peter Parker, and catchphrases like your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, or it's clobbering time, or face a tiger, you just hit the jackpot, and on the Hulk smash. I mean, that's not great literature, Hulk smash, but it's powerful. Those are all Stan.
Well, that page that you just mentioned, face a tiger, you just hit the jackpot, the first appearance of Mary Jane Watson in the comics. And leading up to that, you know, there had been months in which Aunt May had tried to cajole Peter into having a blind date with her friend's niece.
Right.
And Peter didn't want to do it. And then all of a sudden he opens the door and there's this gorgeous John Romita drawn gal.
Yeah.
And you reproduce it so beautifully in Superheroes. The wonderful thing about the companion book that you wrote along with Michael Cantor is, you know, just a chance to look at these graphics. They go by kind of quickly in the television special.
Sure, as well they would. But I think that, you know, for your readers who are listening, probably in the last 20 years or so, most books about comics that are illustrated are either produced by Marvel or by DC. And so you don't usually get a kind of visual crossover, but because of the nature of the licensing for the documentary, it's one of the few books that really has the seminal illustrations of both companies, along with Image and Fawcett and Quality and Dark Horse and even some Archie comics when they entered the superhero game. So it's really thrilling for me to have, exactly like you say, that shot, and also have some great panels from Green Lantern, Green Arrow that Neil Adams drew in the 70s, as well as some obscure illustrations of Jack Kirby went back to Marvel, I think in the mid-70s, and drew some pictures of him and Stan as the Fantastic Four. So we have those pictures as well. So it's what we call rare and essential art in the book.
And it's beautifully designed. I love the end papers and...
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
It's a lovely book. Lawrence Maslin, you also get an opportunity to interview some of the great creators, and some of them right in the nick of time.
Yes. Michael Cantor, who's the director of the documentary, has always felt that you kind of have to look at you got to take the Grim Reaper into account whenever you start a new project, sad though that is. And so we started with some of the older people. I mean, the first person we interviewed was Stan, not because, even though he turned 90 recently, or is about to turn 90, he's very robust, but kind of all roads lead to, if you don't get Stan Lee for your superhero documentary, you might as well stay home. So we made sure we got Stan, but then Carmine Infantino, Joe Kubert, two major DC artists of the Golden and Silver Age, as well as Jerry Robinson and Joe Simon, passed away since we interviewed them. So probably their last interviews they ever gave captured on film.
two of the, I guess, most influential artists of the 1960s are featured in your film and in the book, Neil Adams and Jim Steranko. And they both give great commentary. And it's also really kind of fascinating to see them. I mean, I've been a fan of their work, and their creations have lived in my mind. But, you know, here I got a chance to look at them.
Yeah, well, they couldn't be more different. They were probably the most visually adventurous, although in very different ways from each other, artists of the mid-60s into the 70s. Jim Steranko, very influenced by, came out of a graphic illustration background, so he uses a lot of optical art and special effects and weird panel arrangements. And Neil Adams also came from advertising, but he was the first great realist, I mean, he was sort of the Vermeer of comic books, and so you would see things drawn the way you'd never seen them in comic books. They looked, I would say, before the good superhero movies came out 10 years ago, he was probably the person who came closest to rendering superheroes in a realistic way. And they're sort of the alpha and the omega, and we have both of them on camera. Jim, I wouldn't call him reclusive. I would call him maybe selective. I think we interviewed him at an undisclosed location off the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And Neil is a barrel of laughs, very garrulous, very open, very enterprising. So it was great to have them. And if you said you read Superboy in 1966, then you, like me, probably, you know, your heart beat a little faster when you picked up an X-Men or a Nick Fury or an Avengers or a Captain America that had one of those two guys drawing it. They were so special.
Yeah, it was definitely a revolution.
Yep.
And a little bit later in the history of comics, there was a revolution in the writing, and you got two of those guys that were astounding, one being Frank Miller and the other Alan Moore. I guess those two were really the two who really revolutionized the industry.
Yeah, I mean, one line I have in the book is I think it was the summer of 86 was like the last time that comic books were sort of officially innocent, because Dark Knight, which was Frank Miller's invention, and Watchmen really followed right after each other. I mean, there was they ate up most of 1986. And we didn't get Frank Miller. He's hard to get. And Alan Moore is impossible to get. But we had a lot of interviews of them in other media. So they are in the documentary, and they are very seminal figures in the book, of course.
We're talking with Lawrence Maslin, and his book is called Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of the Comic Book Culture. And he's also the author, along with his partner Michael Cantor, of a three-hour documentary for PBS, now on Blu-ray and DVD. What are your favorite books?
Well, I'm a little different from most folks. I guess I got into the superheroes in the late 60s. I was a big Marvel guy, although I had my DCs. And then I got very much into the history of comics through our friend Jim Steranko, who put out a wonderful...
Oh, that big oversized history.
Oversized two-volume thing. And I got very interested in the pulps, because about the same time, I want to say it was 73, Marvel released a limited series of Doc Savage comic books, and DC released a limited series of Shadow comic books, and I just fell in love with those two characters and went back and read as many of the paperbacks and pulps as I could get my hands on. So I kind of like somebody, always, now they're always asking me, who's your favorite hero? I kind of like the do-it-yourselfers, I call them. People like Doc Savage or Batman, who really had to earn their stripes in the superhero world. They didn't get struck by a bolt of lightning. They didn't come from another planet. They weren't given a ring by an alien in a spaceship. They had to really do their homework and their push-ups. And so those are my kind of guys. So those are the sort of stories I liked. And I guess you'd like a lot of people, Roy Thomas and Stan Lee and Denny O'Neill in the 70s, were sort of better at grounding heroes in that way and in a reality that made you feel, well, maybe if I did really well in social studies, I could be a superhero too.
Well, I did think it was interesting choices of the heroes that are on the cover of your book, that you include the Shadow, because we don't think of him so much as a superhero, but I guess he totally is.
Well, I think we wanted to say to buyers, look, this isn't, we know what happens before Superman, and I think we honor that in the first 20 pages of the book. Is all about the antecedents to the superhero business. So I think it was our little tip of our shadow-like fedora to fans out there that said maybe we kind of did our homework.
Well, of course, Doc Savage, I guess, is famously considered one of the early superheroes. But what about Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan, or Popeye?
Well, you know, they're all sort of in the book, briefly. Popeye was a big influence on Joe Shuster, who drew Superman. And you might say that Superman is a serious version of Popeye, although I think Lois Lane's probably a bit more attractive than Olive Oil.
Just a little.
Tarzan, big, probably one of the first multimedia heroes to go from novels to pulps to comic strips to early serials. And who's the third person you mentioned?
Popeye. Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, Sherlock Holmes. Well, Sherlock Holmes is my ultimate hero. He's the greatest hero who ever existed. And we were able to wrangle a comment out of Stan Lee about Sherlock Holmes, which we quote in the book. He said he thought he was the greatest superhero ever because he was an average guy. He had just trained his mind to excel beyond those of mere mortals. So, yeah, sure, we definitely give a shout-out to those guys as well as the crazy ones. There's a section in the book I really like, which isn't really in the documentary, called Heroes We Have Known and Loved, which are some of the oddballs that aren't really that are hard to talk about in a documentary, which goes by so quickly. But Plastic Man, Dr. Midnight, the first blind superhero, the Silver Surfer, who was this, you know, wonderful philosophical Christ-like figure streaking through Marvel Comics in the 60s and 70s, all the way up to the odder characters and some of the independent comics like Madman and Invincible. So that was fun to write about.
It's a great book, and I think it was a good series. I enjoyed watching it very much, and I also enjoyed your other series that we mentioned a few minutes ago, Make 'Em Laugh, about comedy and the American musical, which those were both done with Michael as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we've worked together for almost a decade.
What are you gonna do next?
Take a break. I am very curious to know, having been a fanboy myself, what the fanboys and girls and men and women are going to say when the book and the series comes out, because they are a tough group to make happy. But I often think a lot about my dentist.
Your dentist?
I did this book. Well, he's a little older, younger than I. He's 50. I'm 54.
Uh-huh.
And he struck me as the target audience because he grew up reading comic books.
Yeah.
60s, and then he stopped probably again in the late 70s, and now he has kids, and they bring home the same comics. They bring back the Winter Soldier, and he said, well, who's the Winter Soldier? Well, it's Bucky. No, it can't be Bucky. Bucky was killed in a plane crash. What are you talking about? So it's a way of getting my dentist to understand what happened since 1980, and it's a way of getting his kids, who maybe started reading in 1990, to understand what happened, you know, for the 40 or so years before that.
Well, I was wondering about your target audience, because I think, you know, people who are devoted comic book fans probably know all the stuff and would rather tell it themselves and would argue with the way you told it. And people who don't know anything about superheroes and comics maybe wouldn't be interested in watching 3 hours about it.
Well, you can't not know now about superheroes. I mean, they're so ubiquitous. Certainly the movies is that huge quantum leap. So for me, the book and the series answers the question, how did we get here? And how did we get to this point where Avengers is the number three? You can't not know that. I mean, you can't not know there was a movie called The Avengers or Man of Steel or Batman Begins.
Right.
And what did they come from? And you'd be astonished, I think. Your average Joe and Jane may be able to pick Batman out of a police lineup or something, but you say they came from the Depression? You're kidding me. Or the various iterations of these heroes, or how popular they were in World War II, or the ethnic background of the people who created them and why. So I think there's a lot of, even people who have a passing knowledge should understand they're not going away anytime soon. I mean, Michael and I say somewhat jocularly that after the book and the series, there's no mother in America who'll throw away their kid's comic book collection. But even if they could, they can't go to Barnes & Noble and throw away the entire graphic novels collection. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things are in print, and they're easily 50 titles you and I could name that will always be in print. They have to be, because they're seminal parts of American literature and American culture now.
Well, that's interesting, because you talk, you said, from the point of view of, as a writer. And as a fan of well-written comic books, I'm not a huge fan of their movie versions. I understand that a comic book is meant to appeal to 150,000 people, and a movie is meant to appeal to millions and millions of people. But it does seem to me that even though they are technically able to give you the visual impact of superheroes now, they're still not particularly good at telling the story.
Well, I guess the question is, what story are they telling? I mean, for me, Superman 1 and Superman 2, especially Superman 2, actually, in the 70s,
mm-hmm. the Christopher
felt,
Reeve.
They felt like a comic book. I mean, they were fun, and they were romantic, and they were spectacular. And not every comic book is great. You got to do one every month, and you've got how many superheroes flying around in your stable. So I'm inclined, essentially, to agree with you, but if you're sitting, as I have often sat, at the AMC Lowe's Theater on 42nd Street on the midnight show the night before a good comic book movie comes out, like Avengers or one of the Batman movies, you're having a good time. And you're having a good time because you're digging seeing your favorite characters up there being done well.
I did think the Watchmen movie was okay.
Yeah, I thought that was, but that's such a complicated source material. But they did a fair job.
But in terms of, say, Spider-Man is such a great character, and the first, say, 100 issues of Spider-Man are a magnificent body of work. I mean, they're well-written, well-drawn, both by Ditko and Romita.
And Gil Kane later on, too.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. That's, you know, that's great stuff, and it's just 100 times better. Just like any great book is usually better than its movie adaptation. Those are better than any of the Spider-Man movies that they've made.
Well,
I say.
Fair enough. As a body of work, yes, absolutely. But, you know, if it keeps people interested and it's not too schlocky, I remember the Doc Savage movie in 1975, which, you know, I think I saw projected on 16mm on a bedsheet at a convention or a comic book convention.
Yeah.
So we've definitely improved.
Yes. No, I mean, they definitely have gotten good. Visually, they know how to do that part. I thought the Captain America movie was pretty good, too.
Until the end, when they seem to always have these Manichean slugfests at the end of these movies.
There's a lot of fighting in them. But,
yeah.
You know, and you know, I can remember a couple of issues. I can't remember the number, but there's an issue of Spider-Man, that one of the Ditko issues, in which Peter Parker is in it and Spider-Man isn't.
Uh-huh. They were very good at that and sustaining your interest. I have to say one quick thing,
mm-hmm.
Which really has nothing to do with comic books, but everything to do with Santa Cruz.
Yes.
Is that I spent that with one of the happiest summers of my life in Santa Cruz, because my wife was an actress at is an actress, and she did a summer at Shakespeare Santa Cruz.
Oh.
If local listeners are out there, write your congressman or write whoever you have to write to get Shakespeare Santa Cruz back on the map.
The death of Gwen Stacy, one of the great moments in comic book history that you cover in your book.
Yep.
Why is that so significant?
Well, it's significant, A, because it was surprising. It was in the pre-internet world where you didn't know, you didn't get a kind of glimpse ahead. There were no sneak previews. You picked up your whatever that was, I want to say 20 cents comic, but I could be wrong. Don't write letters in. I think it was 20 cents. And you had no idea until you got to the last page that Gwen Stacy was going to die. And in the continuity of comic book characters, as Jerry Conway, who is the author of that issue, said, Superman always saved Lois Lane. And here Spider-Man not only doesn't save the damsel in distress, it's his girlfriend, it's Peter Parker, the woman he loves most in the world, other than Aunt May, of course, dies, and he's somewhat responsible for it. And that was reality in a comic book, and that set the trajectory, I think, to where we are now. There's a line I love from a book called Batman Year One. Dave Mazzucchelli, who is the artist, said, once you start making superheroes too realistic, they stop becoming believable. Which is a wonderful paradox, which I think sums that up, the why superheroes are fascinating. And the death of Gwen Stacy, that issue is the one that really set the ball rolling to make comics more realistic.
And therefore less believable?
I don't know. I think that's a good issue. I think that's a good thing to tangle with. I mean, that's what makes you read some comics and you go, do I really want to know what Batman's electricity bill is down in the Batcave? No, I don't think so. But do
or
I want
why? I guess that's when you start asking questions. Like, if you had superpowers,
right?
Would you immediately start running around in your underpants, or would you immediately take a 12-year-old boy with you wherever you went while
right.
you're running around?
People might talk, but that's what Stan Lee said. If I had a superpower, I'd go on the Jay Leno show,
uh-huh.
and that's essentially what Spider-Man does. He
right.
does in the Ed Sullivan show. So, but it makes it interesting because the readers get older. I mean, you and I, it sounds like, aren't spring chickens.
No.
I'm almost
30.
You don't look it on the air. But as we get older, we want heroes to maybe correspond a little bit with what we're dealing with in life. So it's a delicate balance, and I think that's exciting. I don't think you can ever solve it. You just live in the tension between reality, between the Spider-Man's comic book wasn't called Amazing Reality. It was called Amazing Fantasy, and fantasy and reality crashing against each other is what makes heroic fiction exciting.
This book is called Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture. It is the tie-in to the PBS series Superheroes, The Never-Ending Battle, written by Michael Cantor and my guest, Lawrence Maslin. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's great. I'm glad you enjoy comic books. What shall we say it together? Excelsior. Right?
Enough said.
There you go.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. And you can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Lawrence Maslin. He and his partner, Michael Cantor, are the authors of Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture, and of the PBS documentary Superheroes, The Never-Ending Battle, now airing on your PBS station and also available on DVD and Blu-ray. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you later.